All right. All right, we have another 15 seconds. The F-35s today, it's a big simcha. The new planes are arriving. Having a big... So I walked the shul this morning, as I always do, with Sam Dershowitz, my neighbor. So we reminded each other, were you in the country when the F-15s came in, or 16s, and Friday night with Robin, and it brought the government down with the Chilul Shabbos, remember that? So today, Baruch Hashem, you see the change in the atmosphere here. You can still make Havdalah on last week. It's Monday. We don't have a problem. Anyway, I just want to say today is December 12, 2016, and I say hello to my students in front of me and to the many around the world. I just want to share with my students in front of me, I had a lot of nachat. My one of my grandsons sent me this picture. This is his grandfather. My 8 books, and I don't know where he got that New York Yankee mirror. I mean, this is a kid who was born in Yerushalayim, right? He was in America seeing his other grandparents a few times, but he's at the Technion, he's in heavy medical research. I don't know where he got it, but I just wrote back to him that you have caught the essence of your grandfather. Also, before I begin, I just want to tell you once again around Thanksgiving Day, the talk comes up about that the Rebbe observed, that, you know, Rebbe Moshe, the tshuva, what's going on? So, everyone quotes me and they don't have to quote me. I'm an eyewitness. I'm not these eyes and these ears. I write about it in Washington, how the Rebbe, I can never forget it. I was sitting here, you know, I sat here, the Rebbe, Aaron Lichtenstein sat here. The pictures show, I'm not bluffing. Rebbe Aaron was here, I was here, the Rebbe was here. And that week, the Rebbe gave shiur Wednesday, Thursday, because he had a wedding in Boston Tuesday night. So I remember Wednesday when we ended shiur at about 3 o'clock, he looks at his watch. Tomorrow, we're going to make the shiur very early, 9 o'clock. You'll be here, you know, in America, 9 o'clock. Who heard of shiur? So I say, Rebbe, why so early? He says, Arnold, don't you know what tomorrow is? It's Thanksgiving Day, and I promised my wife we'd be at my sister's for Thanksgiving dinner by 2 o'clock. You had to make the plane, the 12 o'clock plane, to get to Boston in time to be at his sister's at 2. So Moshe Nice, a lawyer, but he learned in the yeshiva in the 70s, I can add the following amusing tale. I heard this from others, by the way, so anyone in the shiur left a big impression. It was Thanksgiving Day in 1972, and we in the Rav Shiur were in a collective great mood. It was announced that our shiur would begin at 10 a.m., not the usual 11 a.m. Immediately, we had vacation-like visions dancing in our heads, figuring there would be no way shiur would go past noon. Imagine half a day off. It was not to be. 1 p.m. approached, and there was no sign from the Rav that he was anywhere near finishing shiur. All the YU buildings were closed for the holiday, and we had shiur in the official base medrash. We glanced at one another, all disappointed at overtime. Now, you may recall that in those days, the Thanksgiving Day football rivalry was Green Bay Packers versus Detroit Lions. A bit after 1 p.m., suddenly one of the guys gets up. He later became quite a prominent rabbi. Interrupts the Rebbe and says, "But Rebbe, how about the Lions and the Packers? We could not believe what had transpired." The Rav stopped in mid-sentence and looked at the miscreant for what seemed an eternity as the rest of us waited for the cataclysmic explosion that we thought was to follow. The Rav then shut his gemara and said, "You are all right, boys. Go home and enjoy your turkey." End quote. So, all right, that ends all machloket. All right, now I want to begin, and I want to fill in the background. Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner, you know, again, this was a figure that I heard about, knew about. I cannot say that I interacted with him directly. I cannot say that I knew the full picture. But very interestingly, last year, I always visit Shari Tfila in Lawrence. I have a lot of virtual students there. And it must be 10 years at least that every year I give 3 shiurim there. And it's very, you know, I have to tell you, it's a wonderful shul, a very nice crowd, and people I feel very much at home with. As a matter of fact, people were joking around. I don't know, they were half serious, but they had problems with their rabbi. And you may recall that the rabbi left, and for 2 years they were without a rabbi. And they wanted me to stay for a year and give them a chance. And they said, everyone loves you. Why does everyone love you? Because we have 2 elements in the shul, a YU element and a Lakewood element, and you fit in with both of them. You're right. What? So I told them, look, I'm very moved. I said that you even consider this. It's humbling to me. Shari Tfila, I was here as a kid when I learned Bechavruta with Rabbi Rachman's son. I was here when Rabbi Wurzburger was rabbi, and I am very moved. But I have to be honest with you. If I leave Israel for more than 40 days, I forget all my Torah. All that remains with me is baseball. You certainly don't want a rabbi in this shul. All he's going to talk about is the Macho Henrik and Keller. So we all had a good laugh. But last year, for some reason, they said to me, Rebbe, we'd like you to talk about Rav Yitzchak Kuttner. So I got to work on Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, and I have to say, I gave a lecture there, and, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, it's not much you can do. But a world of material came up, and I do have some other connections. Namely, my wife in college took classes with Brewery Hutner. So, and you'll see, not today, not next week, it'll take me a little while, I'll get to Brewery and I'm going to say something very sharp, and I hope that Talmidim of Rav Hutner and who know Brewery, I'll be very happy to hear how they react to my chiddush, my insight. Also, which is Minishamayim Zikuni, in college, I'm probably one of the few people in the world that studied with all 3 Soloveitchik brothers. In college, first of all, the Rav was my Rebbe. In 1960, 59-60, you all know the Rav had a major operation, and chances were he wouldn't recover. Thank God he did recover. But while he was in the hospital, and while he couldn't teach, his brother Reb Aaron took over his shiur. So I also studied with Reb Aaron, and I became very, very close to Reb Aaron. On a personal level, we interacted many times over. His son lives in Yerushalayim. As a matter of fact, he told his son, when his son came in Aliyah, his son came Ravak, and his son is a genius, and all geniuses have fault lines. So I told his son, whenever you have to make a big decision, go see Rabbi Rotkoff. He has common sense. And then we became very friendly. And in college, my chemistry professor was Rav Shmuel Soloveitchik. So I knew Rav Shmuel very well. I have a card from him. Let me not talk about myself. A beautiful card thanking me for being his student. Could you imagine? So Malka and I got married. Rav Shmuel and his wife Batsheva made a Sheva Brachas for us. And Batsheva was a very unique individual. Everyone called her Rebbetzin Soloveitchik. She, Europe, ran away with miracles, survived, went through the hell and got to America, came from a very distinguished rabbinic family, related to many Gedolei Yisrael. And the way life worked out, you all know Shmuel, Reb Shmuel died young. It was tragedy in their life. They had no children. And while he died that year, a great lady died here. She was the Skan Menahel Klali of the Misrad HaPnim, which always was in the hands of Mizrahi, of what we called later Maftal. They had a chazaka. Today Shas has a chazaka on the Misrat HaPnim. She was the Skan Menahel Klali. She was the daughter of a Hasidic Rebbe. She was the niece of the B'chechna Rebbe, of the Eish Kodesh. Okay? You're with me? And they made a shidduch. B'zivik Sheni, she married. The books are here today. You remember you asked, so Natan is in charge. We'll, after class, we'll mention. Okay. So she was the Skan Menahel Klali, and she died young. So they made a shidduch with her Alman and Batsheva, and they got married in 1968 in Switzerland. Why did they get married in Switzerland? Because whenever you have a Zivik Sheni, there are always problems who to invite, which I see you laughing, but you understand the problems. It's the children you don't invite. They didn't have, they only had one daughter. One daughter. The Soloveitchiks had none. And Hutner, Rabbi Hutner, they had one daughter, Abigail. And also friends. So if you go to Switzerland and get married there, there's no problem who to invite, who not to invite. It's awkward. It can be awkward at times. I'm a living example of someone who, they used to call me, I remember Pam's brother, Charlie Pam, when he remarried, he had me speak with his children, because children at times resented, and you have to understand that life has to go on. It's unfortunate, but that's the way God built the world. So my mother had a very happy second marriage, with Reb Moshe Aberbach. Reb Moshe Aberbach, one son graduated college with me and one son got smicha with me. Elliot got smicha with me and David graduated college with me. So it was a beautiful second marriage. So at that time, it was right after the Six-Day War, and they were building a new building on Rehov Rav Chaim Berlin. Rav Chaim Berlin basically was built up, a block and a half was built up already with old buildings, but there was one big space where they could build something new, and the Hutners bought into the building. When we came in Aliyah, it was a miracle min Shemayim that we bought into the same building. I need not tell you what we paid and what the value is today of the building. Not that it helps me, because I need a roof over my head, but we moved in. We're from the original settlers. We all moved in 69, Rav Chaim Berlin 18, and they were our closest neighbors, our closest friends. They were one flight under us. And whatever, the relationship was really, I don't believe brothers could have as good as a relationship as Yehoshua and I had and Malka and Batsheva had. So obviously, being so close to Rabbi Yehoshua Hutner, I got to learn a great deal about his first cousin, Rav Yitzchak Hutner. As a matter of fact, when Rav Hutner would come to visit his cousin when he visited Israel, so Rav Yehoshua would tell me, and I'd wait downstairs to take the Rosh Yeshiva and his wife up by elevator, take them to the Hutners, and we got to know each other a little bit better. Now, what's fascinating and disappointing, and here I've said this many times, I say it again. The right-wing world, for whatever the reasons are, has a lot of trouble facing the truth. It's just sad. Art Scroll, which has done a beautiful job in their Gemara and their Mishnayot, when it comes to their history books, if 50% of what they write is correct, I may be overstating the case. And you all know when Reb Nesson Kamenetsky came out with his two volumes, The Making of a Gadol. So I met Reb Nesson the day the books came off the press. We davened together in the shtibel near Machne Yehuda, called Mincha together, the Sundal Shul. You know what I'm referring to? Soarei Chamatz. It was built by Americans, and there's a big sundial where you could tell time on top of the building. They don't have Shachrit Minyanim there, but Mincha Marev, I think they have, is maybe only in Geula, in the other shtibel in Geula, maybe the only other place that has more Minyanim, Mincha Marev. So We met in the Sundal Shul, and he was so happy. And you all know what happened to him. It was a mamish life-threatening. His book burned on the streets in Mata stuff. The New York Times did a tremendous article on it. And La Yehuda Maitar Rav Simcha's Given Lebedik. And all because he wrote a truthful volume. And you all know that a guy named Rakefet defended him. I wrote a review in Jewish Action. I defended him. I mean, it was unbelievable how they jumped on him, how he portrayed that Reb Aaron Cutler wrote letters to his wife-to-be. What? How could he have written letters? And I said, maybe, we know what the letters were that he wrote. He wrote letters to his wife-to-be. Those letters have surfaced, or at least people swear they saw them. It was telling his wife what books to read in Russian. Reb Aaron knew Russian literature, and he's recommending to her what she would find enjoyable and meaningful. But they said he wrote letters. What did he write? Love letters. So I said in public, and it resounded across the world, that it's wonderful. The Bachrim should learn how to write love letters to their wives-to-be and know what romance is about. Maybe we'd have a lot less divorce in this world than we have. And what's so terrible, Reb Aaron wrote. All right, there's a lot to talk about. I'll leave it at that. I can go on and on with episodes that he describes. Fabulous. It shows human beings, Gedolei Yisrael, interacting. But what's amazing about Art Scroll, they have biographies of many Gedolei Yisrael, including, let's say, Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Mordechai Gifter, many Gedolei Yisrael, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, before the making of a Gadol, Jonathan Rosenblum, if I have his name correctly, wrote on Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, and they have many, many biographies. Two of the most important people who surface in the United States, there is no definitive biography by Art Scroll, not of Reb Aaron Cutler, and not of Reb Yitzchak Kutner. V'hamikra hazeh omer darsheni. How can you not have a biography of Reb Aaron Cutler when all is said and done? Who influenced American Judaism? Who influenced the world Judaism? There are only three names you can give about America. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Aaron Cutler, and Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. There's no other name that comes up to that level of influence. All right, Reb Moshe Feinstein brought Pesach to America. But the influence was very limited. Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky was a fine Rosh Yeshiva. Reb Mordechai Gifter was a wonderful Rosh Yeshiva. I spoke about when I dealt with Das Torah. I look back at it and I cry that he didn't remain in Israel. His whole life would have been different. He was such a lover of Eretz Yisrael. And of course, it was a family institution. When Rabbi Sretzkin died, they needed him back in Cleveland. And he lived in the dormitory. You should know that. He never moved out. He was always with his suitcase packed to go back to Israel. What would have been in Tel Stone, and he remained here. But all right, the Haredi world works within its own parameters. But Reb Aaron Cutler, not to have a definitive biography. But the reason is very simple. Art Scroll cannot do a biography of Reb Aaron Cutler because they can't skip over what for them are the black moments. And those black moments are too well known. Anyone who learned in Lakewood in my time, and I imagine 10 years afterwards, it's like I told Reb Nassim Kamenetsky, all your stories about Reb Aaron Cutler and his sister and getting on the train or the bus or whatever, the trolley, to go to Moscow, to go to university, and Reb Reuven Grzybowski pulling him off. I said, I knew all this in Lakewood. It's no chiddush to me. I said, what they're hanging you on and burning your book. These were facts. We all knew it. Reb Aaron struggled. And that's beautiful. It's important. It's informative. No. Chas v'chalila, the kids should see that Reb Aaron has a sister who became a great mathematician, a communist, a professor, a socialist. Then in France, then she wound up in America. And you know the story. I mean, Rabbi Albert came back at the Shrukana, he and Rabbi Schoenfeld. Reb Aaron's sister had never married. She was Kulo professor, Kulo scholarship. and she had no children. So she was in a senior citizens in Queens. So Rabbaran asked the Queens rabbinate, which is a very unique, wonderful rabbinate, was called the Queens Mafia. There was no rabbinate in America that got along as well as the Queens Mafia. They mamish were good rabbanim, honest rabbanim. They raised wonderful children, and they got along with each other. So they were the Queens Mafia. So Rabbaran asked them to visit his sister once a month, that she should have company once a month. So I think where Fabian Schoenfeld picks up a phone to Roy Albert, Rabbi Albert, and says to him, come, you'll have an interesting afternoon. I just want to make the mic drop less, hear feedback. Come, you'll have an interesting afternoon. We're going to visit Malka Cutler, Rabbaran's sister. And they go to visit her. And, you know, she sees Rabbanim, that Yiddish, they're talking Yiddish. And she says, oh, mein Arala is given a zagon in my mathematica gone, a zagonische cup. Was is geworden mit dem? A kleiner Rebeler hat at mir gehitten, that the given heim the gräste professor. You follow me? Rabbanim's sister said this to, do you understand? Rabbanim's sister said this to them. And if you read, there's an in-house biography on Rabbaran Cutler that came out after Kamenetsky's book, Rabbi Kamenetsky's book, Dershowitz. One of the Dershowitzes, not Alan, this is a cousin who's in Lakewood, Yitzchak Dershowitz, I believe it is. So you'll see there that Rabbaran had a sister, but she was not an agudist. She was a Mizrachist. She was a religious Zionist. Religious Zionist. How you can lie with a straight face. It hurts, though. It hurts. Alan, anyway, be it as it may, they don't have a biography of Rabbaran Cutler because they're caught in the quagmire. Exactly the same thing with Rav Yitzchak Kuttner. Rav Yitzchak Kuttner was not Rabbaran Cutler, didn't have the same influence, didn't have the same impact, but he was unique. He was not, he didn't fit in to the pattern, the tipus. He walked in his own path. And there are parts of his biography which today they can't handle in art scroll. Here was a man who was in favor of the yeshiva in Brooklyn opening a college. And they're facts. The documents have surfaced. It's been published. These are legal documents. He was in favor. They were all ready to go. All right. They had to back off because of Rabbaran Cutler. He was a man who was very friendly with Rav Kook. And his entire thrust later in life as a Rebbe was the Maral's philosophy, the Pachat Yitzchak. Who introduced him to the Maharal? Rav Avram Yitzchak, a Kohen Cook. This was not in Litta. Someone just gave a lecture on the Rav, Rabbi Dalfin. I should correct him, but maybe he'll listen to the Shir. He'll hear the correction. He was speaking about Rabbi Soloveitchik, how much Rabbi Soloveitchik knew. He's a very open-minded person. Rabbi Dalfin is a Chabadnik from birth, but he has great appreciation for the Rav as well. So he says, the Rav knew this, the Rav knew that, the Rav knew Maharal. I have to tell you, the Rav did not know Maharal. He never made a claim to know Maharal. If you want a true story that you'll never forget, I'll share with you what an idiot yours truly can be. Bididi Haviyufta. Very simple. Rabbi Manny Holes has saved my life. If you're familiar with Washington, so you know the story. I came to Israel and I didn't know where I was. I went to Merkaz Harav. I loved the learning there, but I saw their attitude towards university. College was not the attitude that I was brought up with. I went to Hebron. And I saw not only their attitude towards university, but their attitude towards many aspects of the Israeli population. It frightened me. The Yiddish I learned there, the terrible words that they used. Ah. And here I am, a man without a spiritual place to hang my hat. And in the second year of BMT, this must mean 70, 71 on Rehov HaBarbanel 24, I had a student, Jay Holzer, and I evidently was the first Rebbe that inspired this student. And his father was very thankful to me. And he started feeding me tapes of the Rav. And Baruch Hashem, it was like having Rebbe in the room next to me. Reels, clear, not recorded clandestinely, but illegal copies of what Manny, Rabbi Holzer, recorded the Rav, and here I have the Rav sitting next to me, clear as a crystal. Anyway, by that time, the Rav had started a new nohag, a new practice of the summer shirm called the Yachei Kala. Yachei Kala, after his wife died, and the Rav was not teaching during the summer, the Rav was very, very upset. So they arranged for children, the family Fürstein, to bring up from New York 10, 20 youngsters to learn with the Rav. And then all the rabbis would come at the end of the summer for 3 days of learning with the Rav, the Yachei Kala. And there would be recordings of this. And Manny was feeding me the recordings. And I never forget this 1974 Yachei Kala, dealing with Sefer HaMitzvot, and they're talking with the Rav about Ruach HaKodesh, about rabbinic enactments, and I'm listening so intently, and someone from the audience shoots at the Rav, but the Maharal says, and the Rav says, who are you quoting? The Maharal? That's not in my Beis Medrash. Says nicht in mein Beis Medrash. You know the Rav, he could talk like this. We can't talk like this. So don't overstate the case. Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner was introduced to the Maharal not by Litter, but by Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. So when you deal with Rav Kuttner, there are aspects of the individual that Art Scroll would have a lot of difficulty with. And we have no definitive biography of a man who was very unique, idiosyncratic, not part of the crowd, walked to his own tune, had tremendous influence on tens and tens of Talmidim, if not hundreds, who went out to very important positions all over the world, Israel, all over America, elsewhere. A man who created an institution, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin, Kolel Gur Ayeh, Kolel Pachat Yitzchak in Yerushalayim Har Nof, an institution which lives on until today. Certainly Chaim Berlin in America is a thriving institution, one of the important yeshiva. In Israel, all right, there are many Kolelim here, so Pachat Yitzchak takes his place in a long lineup. Now, No one, and then I'm going to show you a very esoteric source that I came upon looking for something else. I found this and I danced for joy. And you get it, it's a special gift just to hear the end of this source. No one grows up on his own. I've spoken to people who become Mechalalei Shabbos, Ochlin, Avedit, and Treifat. And you can't get angry, you can't curse them, you can't maledict them. We spoke about this yesterday in class. What's the status of Jews in Russia under the communists? Are they anusim? Are they tinot b'shenishpam? But I would always say one thing to them. You're not fair to the blood in your veins, in your vessels. Think of the generations before you. Who do you come from? Who brought you into this world? Who was Meisa Nefesh that we should survive as Jews? And you go into the whole talk. You're not just a Western individual. A Western individual, the Western world, the world today of Haaretz, of Obama, of the New York Times, even of Lo Aleinu in Yisrael Hayom, if you took a look on Friday's paper, a big article on two lesbians and the child they brought into the world. Egelhaftig. And this is, that's a world that all is individual happiness. Nothing else counts. individual happiness. Makari Shon had a very good article, I think, was Chaim Navon this week. Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Saar, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, and Rabbi Yehuda Amital. Individual happiness, nothing else matters. We're Jews. We're individual, but we're part of Klal Yisrael, Am Yisrael. Continuity. Yom Machalos Shabbos. And I once said that to a grandson. He was talking to me about tefillah. I said, you know, when you daven, just think it's not only you davening, it's your father davening, your grandfather davening, your great, all the generations that come before you. And the only way that Judaism will continue is that your generations will be davening. And this is the blood in our veins. Rabbi Yehoshua Huttner always used to talk about his grandfather. His grandfather, the same grandfather of Yitzchak Huttner, they were first cousins. Who is his grandfather? Of Yosef Zundel Huttner, the Rav of Yashak, Professor Eliach, Jaffa Eliach, who just died, Zichrona Livracha, Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig's mother-in-law, Smada's mother, Professor Smada Eliach's mother. She wrote a postdoctorate research, a book of 800 pages on the shtetl she came from, Yashak, if I'm pronouncing it right. And she writes about Rabbi Huttner. Now, a sideshow with Rabbi Yosef Zundel Huttner is very interesting. We talk about women, we talk about respective women, role of women. Who ran the city? His Rebbetzin. She was a very strong person. He was learning all the time at Tzadik Yisod Olam. I don't think he ever held a coin in his hand. You follow? Didn't know what a matbeya is, what a pruta is, what a grush is. She ran the city. What's interesting about Rabbi Yehoshua Huttner, both his wives were very great women. His first wife, as I mentioned, and his second wife, Batsheva, and his respect for women. And I would ask him, where did you get this attitude when my daughter became signed up for the new program to become a female rabbinic lawyer? My daughter later becomes the first one in history. So she needed two letters from Rabbanim that she's from and knows how to learn a Daf Gemara. And there was some Rabbanim, let it remain nameless, whom she asked for letters. Oh, they wouldn't give. Rabbi Huttner not only gave a letter, but he calls her back. He says, no, give me back the letter. It's not strong enough. And the next day he gave her a letter, much stronger, beautiful. Well, with that letter, they took her right into the course. But their respect for women, you can understand how Rav Huttner raised the Bruria Huttner. She didn't grow up on her own. She grew up on a tree. There was sustenance. This was her father. There was respect for women. It came from the grandfather. Now, I want to cite a book, Sefer Gedolei Hadorot. It's three volumes on great rabbis. It's organized according to the date of their death. A lot of research was done. The author was Rabbi Yechiel Michel Stern, who I believe is a Rav was a Rav at the time this book was published. It's 20 years ago. He was Rav in Ezra's Torah, in the Ezra Torah section of Yerushalayim. It's the Haredi world. Rav Umorei Tzedek B'Shunat Ezra Torah Yerushalayim Chelek Gimel. And I don't know where he is today, but he may still be in that position. I'm quoting from volume 3, page 956. And it's about Rabbi Yosef Zundel Huttner, who was born in 1919. Am I right? Atar'at. Is where are we today? We're in 2016. Tarat, no, it doesn't make sense that he would be born. That's when he died. Okay, he died. They don't have the date of his birth. He died in 1919. Okay, now he was born in Dvinsk, and in his early years, he learned Bechavruta with Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen. The minute you hear that he learned Bechavruta with Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen, it gives you an idea of what level in learning he was. He was renowned as one of the greatest matmidim in all the rabbinate in Lithuania. Renowned as a tzaddik. And very interesting story here, which we can quote and requote. He was very close to the Chafetz Chaim. And one time, and it's amazing, the Chafetz Chaim's insight, because this happens in the Israeli army. One time he said to the Chafetz Chaim, "I'm very upset. Every yingel gets smicha today. They know very little, and yet the Rabbanim give them smicha." So the Chafetz Chaim told him, "Listen, I remember there was once an episode where the Russian army had to go to war. And when the Russian army had to go to war, they needed a lot of manpower. And they went to their school for the training of officers, and they pulled the officers out, and the commanding officer said to them, 'I know that you haven't finished your training and there's a lot you have to learn, but it's an emergency now. It's pikuach nefesh for the Russian army, for the Russian government. I hope you learn in battle what you should have been trained before. You're going to learn in the field, in practice.'" I see Rabbi Rubin is giving me the sign that I've hit the nail on the head, because Rabbi Rubin is not only an officer in the Israeli army, he was an officer, a chaplain in the American army. Now, the truth of the...
Yeah, that's not the reason I agree with you. I was also a rabbi in the field who had to learn what he didn't know from before.
Well, you learned in battle, in practice. In the Israeli army, I can tell you with my grandsons, all right, I have to admit I did basic training, but it was at the age of 38. We weren't exactly the fighterim that my grandchildren, my sons-in-law and my grandchildren became. But my grandchildren, many times in the middle of a course, for instance, the war in Gaza, 2.5 years ago, courses were closed down and they were sent to the front line. What you haven't learned yet, you learn, unfortunately, right there in battle. So Chafetz Chaim says to him, "It's innate Tzara Yaakov. There's so much irreligiousness, Chilul Shabbos, what was going on in Europe already. It's innate Tzara. We have to pull them out of the schools and send them into the battlefields. And I hope what the Rabbanim don't know from before, they will learn while they're Rabbanim out there in the fields." And by the way, this is the only approach to learning, because when I got smicha, I was an Amoritz 50 times over. How much did I know? Just think for a minute, a hundred. In my time when the Bechinot were oral, and I'm already after the oral Bechinot, it was 100 daf gemara, and sections of Yoredeya. In my time, it was learning Gemara with the Rav, all right? I passed all the exams. What did I learn with the Rav? Parts of Masechet Sanhedrin. We didn't even do all of Sanhedrin. Could you imagine, Charlie, we didn't do Chelek with the Rav? If I could relive my life, I would grab Rebbe and say, "Rebbe, you have to do Chelek with us. We're willing to come an extra day a week. Forget about the easy Sanhedrin, the regular learning, the halacha lemaisa. Chelek, there's no perek in all of Shas with more hashkafa than chelek, right or wrong, how much we need it. The Rambam paskens lalacha, if you're going to quote chelek and try to figure out, tipach rucham, you know, we spoke about it, drop dead, you're a dummy, an idiot, you're not even explain it to us." All right. So I learned a little bit, all right, I learned the halacha of Masechet Sanhedrin, and I learned sections of Yoredeya. Gentlemen, that's what a Rav has to know. All of Shas you have to know. Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch you have to know. How to paskin a difficult shaila you have to know. The heartbeat of Yiddishkeit you have to know. The hashkafa of Yiddishkeit. Ribbono Shel Olam. So the Chafetz Chaim is right. You can't expect the student to know it all. But when that student turns 80, I hope he'll be 100 times smarter than when he was 25. Now we come to the high point. Listen to this. One time, the Chafetz Chaim would send people to Rav Hutner for a bracha. So one time, the Chafetz Chaim asked his Bala Gola, the person who drove the wagon, drove the taxi for him. He was going to Aish HaShishuk. He said, Tuma Teva, do me a favor. Go in to the Rav Hutner and tell him the Chafetz Chaim wants a bracha from you. And Rav Hutner tells the Bala Gola, I quoted, Zolegein Barbis und Tragen Steina, that the Chafetz Chaim should walk without shoes and carry stones. The Bala Gola was so ashamed, he came back to Raten and he tried to avoid the Chafetz Chaim. What's he going to tell him? Finally, the Chafetz Chaim called him in. No, I'm all speaking. Can I speak Yiddish or I have to speak English?
Yiddish,
I can speak. Oh, beautiful. So the Chafetz Chaim said, Was ha bracha? Zag me. And he said, No, Rabbi Hashem said, No, zag me. So he tells him, and the Chafetz Chaim starts shaking and says, Ach, sel azab bracha bechnat nishke kumen halavai zazayim mekuyim un ich bin mevate af de steine. You know what the bracha was? So again, Babas, he should do the avod in the Beis HaMikdash. Chafetz Chaim was a Kohen. The Kohenim can't wear shoes, can't be a chachzitza. Un zalatrogin steine, the Avnei Choshen. And the Chafetz Chaim said, I'll be happy enough just to go barefoot. I don't have to be the Kohen Gadol. But this is who the two Rabbi Hutners came from. This was their grandfather. This is the bracha that he gave the poor Bala Gola, who couldn't start to understand what is the man saying. Okay, now, what I'm going to do is, because people don't know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was easier to talk about because everyone has some idea of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's life. What I'm going to do, Be'ez Rat Hashem, I speak like a Bronxite, what I'm going to do, Be'ez Rat Hashem, I'm going to start a brief biographical sketch of Rav Hutner, and do a biographical sketch. Then we're going to come back, and I'm going to fill in sources and comments on many parts of his biography. Now, Natan, what I want you to tell Alex is, and I'm upset that he's not here, is I'm going to deal with the biography, and obviously we'll touch upon the philosophy, what he tried to do, and some of his letters, but the heart of his philosophy is for Alex to do a doctorate on Rav Hutner and the Maharal. And there, what you have to deal with is, was he Mechadesh in the Maharal, or was it mainly that he popularized the Maharal? And is there Chiddush in his approach to the Maharal? You follow me? And the sources I'm going to quote are very important from a biographical point of view, because a doctorate has to have a biographical structure. But the Maharal and all that goes into it, this I leave for Alex, who has a master's in Jewish in philosophy already from the University of Pennsylvania. It's a very nice topic, and to the best of my knowledge, no one has explored it from that point of view. There were articles, Schwarzfuchs, from who taught theology at the Reform Rabbinic Institutions. He did some work on Rav Hutner and the Maharal, but it was very basic. We need someone to deal with it in depth and deal with Rav Hutner and all the sources he quotes, how he puts it into context. But we'll get there. Okay.
Maybe you should give us a short bio of the Maharal.
Yeah, well, the Maharal, all you have to do is open up the Encyclopedia Judaica. It's not.
Yeah, you can tell that about
anybody. But not about Rav Hutner. But the Maharal, a lot has been written on, a lot has been worked out, and there you have it in 10 minutes. You have it right there. But the Maharal goes back hundreds of years. Rav Hutner is contemporary, but the Maharal's work was resuscitated in contemporary times. It's not just Rav Chutna, the Maral already, the Svay. Everyone quotes the Maral today. It was resuscitated. Why in contemporary times? Probably because of the eschatological overtones. You're dealing with Eretz Yisrael, you're dealing with perhaps the Atkalta of the Geula, and there's a world in the Maral that went beyond the era in which he lived. This is the impression I have, but I'm not an expert in Jewish philosophy. As I've said many times, I would love to be an expert in Shas and Paiskim and the history of Torah. Jewish philosophy never excited me, and the answer is very simple. Why doesn't it excite me? Because I saw the Shanghai crowd. And once you saw those Jews, you didn't have any philosophic questions anymore. You follow? They know, when I'm Reb Henoch Fishman, I don't have to go beyond Reb Henoch Fishman. Just to think of him, the Edelkeit, the decency, the honesty, the truthfulness. Can't go further. No questions. All questions answered. It's like the story with Uri Zohar and the Shabbat he spent in where do you live? In Shari Chesed. The Shabbat he spent in Shari Chesed with the family that today is the old city. They conquered the old city. We spoke about it, the Zuberman family. You know what I'm talking about? Right, so I'll digress for a minute. I don't like to repeat myself, but every year it's new students. Sometimes you have to. It's a very interesting story. Uri Zohar, when we came in Aliyah, 69, Uri Zohar was Mr. Entertainment in Israel. Charlie, when you came, things hadn't changed yet. Uri Zohar, the movies, the TV, which was just beginning in Israel. And then suddenly, Uri Zohar, Mr. Israel, Mr. Tel Aviv, Mr. Haaretz. Suddenly, he appears on television with a kippah. The next week, he appears with his tzitzit out. The third week, he covers up the semi-nude woman that was the back screen for his show. Now, the world went crazy. The next week, he disappears entirely. And everyone wonders what happened to Uri Zohar. He's learning. The story starts leaking out. It's an unbelievable story. Because it's not just that he became a Jew again. Went back to, I can't use the word Baal Tshuva, because he cried. He would speak in public. My most precious heritage was never taught to me in the state of Israel. I went to school in Tel Aviv. I learned this. I learned that. I never learned what Torah is about. His wife faced a great dilemma. She married Uri Zohar. By the way, he was a loyal husband. He didn't play around. He and Eric Einstein did not play around with other women, even when they weren't from. They experienced drugs, a little liquor occasionally, but they were good, loyal spouses. So he said to her, I'd like you to come with me on this journey. And he studied Rambam with her. And she decided to go along. And of course, the children, two of his teenagers had children already, they all went along. It's an amazing thing. These were two of them were teenagers already. Not so simple. Those two married Eric Einstein's two children. In other words, a boy married a girl and a girl married a boy. So that Einstein and Uri Zohar were mechutanim twice over. Einstein wrote a song about Uri Zohar. I'll never forget it. My dearest friend Chazah b'tshuva, and it's like he dropped dead. The song, you can hear it, you can hear it. It's not an esoteric song. Eric Einstein's wife became a tzaddikit. They got divorced. She devoted the rest of her life, Zichrona Livracha, to charity, to helping Kalat, poor Kalat. That's the story with Driga. I tell it, I cry, I can't help myself. Story with Riga, that when she left Riga in the late 30s to go on Aliyah, to run away, so the Riga was Chabad, that's where the sixth Rebbe ran away from Russia before he went to Warsaw. He was in Riga, few good years. So this Jew, a young man at the time, but a Chabadnik, said to her, you're going in Aliyah, you should remember, as du bist a Yiddish Tochter, vergess nicht, don't forget. And many years went by, and in the early 90s, he got out. When a million Jews came to Israel, he was one of them. He now is an elderly Yid in his 90s, and she went to see him. And she told him, ich hab nicht vergessen. Ich hab geblieben. Ein jüdische Tochter. It's very moving. It was on TV, it was in all the newspapers here, early 90s. And he died shortly afterwards, Chabadnik. But she proudly told him, I didn't forget. So everyone wondered, how did Uri Sochab become from? And no one knew the story. In 1988, there was a terrible tragedy. A bus was attacked by firebombs circling Yericho. It was right before the election, and a daughter of the family of the old city of Shari Tzedek, where the grandfather lived, they were of English origins, German to England to Israel. Zilberman, his daughter was killed. Could also be a grandchild was killed. Two grandchildren, a terrible tragedy. The Haaretz attributed that tragedy as being the catalyst for Begin's re-election in 88. And they were sitting shiva at the Zilberman home. And the reporters noticed that Uri Zohar is hanging out around the home. So they got hold of Uri Zohar. They said, what are you doing here? And he finally broke down and told the story how he became frum. He became frum in the 70s. He had all these questions. A normal person has questions. It's like Yitzchak, the manuscript I gave you. That story I told you was told in the Kollel many years ago. He came to see me. And he told the story. Someone in England, Manchester to London, from a Haredi background, he turned 30, threw away all of Yiddishkeit, divorced his wife, everything, left, lived with an Arab woman in London. And 10 years later, he turned 40, and it bothered him, why am I in the world? And someone told him, I don't know who told him, but someone said to him, why don't you go to YU Torah, there's a guy, Rak Kefet, listen to the Shiurim. And as they say, the rest is history. Tremendous Talmud Chacham Yirei Shemayim today lives in Israel, published Sfarim, beautiful dedication to his Rebbe. So Uri Zohar started to ask questions. So he's asking this one, he's asking that one. Someone finally said to him, look, there's a rabbi in Shaarei Chesed, English origins, German origins originally, Zilberman. He can answer all your questions. So Uri Zohar contacts Rabbi Zilberman. It's the grandfather of the current Zilbermans. And he says to him, I have this question and that question. Your person finally meets, you're exploding, you want to get it all out of you. And Rabbi Zilberman says to him, I'm not going to answer any of your questions. Spend a Shabbat with me. And you'll see at the end of Shabbat, you won't have any more questions. So he makes one condition. You can't drive. We'll talk about this in the Sunday class, maybe the next week in the Russian context. You can't drive. So he stayed at the King's Hotel. If you know where the King's Hotel is and you know where Shaarei Chesed is, it's a 2-3-4 minute walk. The end of Shabbat, Uri Zohar said, all my questions were answered. So they asked him, what do you mean? So Uri Zohar said, I'll give you one. I'm shalachem mashal echad. One mashal. He said, when Rabbi Zilberman walked into the room, all his children stood up for him. Where I'm coming from in Tel Aviv, all our children don't talk to us and run away, want to have nothing to do with us. He said, he said, I have no other, I'm not going to tell you anything else. That's it. And he became, and he, by the way, he writes this in his book, in Uri Zohar wrote an autobiography afterwards, it's translated into English, I'm told. He tells the story just as I'm telling it. So when Yitz asked me about the Maharal, I have to be truthful. I loved when the Rav got involved in Agada, in homiletics. When he took philosophy, what I got out of the Rav was he was using the homiletics to explain the philosophy, and the philosophy explained the homiletics. That I could love, I was enthralled. But Stam philosophy, how do we know who we are? How do we know God exists? How do we know there's a reward in punishment? You know, the classic topics. Bitachon and Hishtatlut. I think back to the Shanghai crowd, and I don't have any questions and any problems. This is the way a Jew has to live. Now, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner was born in 1906. He died in 1980. He was born in Warsaw, and his family had both types of these people, forebears, Chassidim, Gera Chassidim, and Litvisha Mitnagdim. Both traditions existed in his family. His parents were later killed in the Holocaust, and he only found out that his parents were killed in 1946. Imagine the whole Shoah, the whole Holocaust. He knew nothing. Only in 1946, when survivors started arriving in America, when survivors started arriving and there were people from his background, his youth, and they knew already his parents were killed. He was known as the Vasheva Ilui, had a very brilliant mind. And you know, when you have a brilliant mind, you see it already when a kid is a kid. The challenge is to channel that ability. But I need not tell you, you see it when I have one grandson when he was 5 years old. He was doing mathematical problems that I couldn't solve in a million years. He was 5 years old at the time. All right, today he's in the Technion doing mathematical problems that I hope his professors can solve. But he was brilliant, the Vasheva Ilui. He had one advantage that most people don't have. His parents were wealthy. His father was a businessman. And that gave him the ability to do whatever he wanted. There was never a problem of money. Who's going to pay for it? If I can make an analogy, because you'll see about his life in a minute, I'll make an analogy. I had a classmate. I won't mention the name, but there's nothing that what I'm saying is negative. Yitzchak will recognize the person. He married a very wealthy, a daughter from a very, very wealthy Torah family. A wonderful family. I can tell you one little story out of that wedding that a third fellow, part of our Chabura, came to the wedding, had a jalopy. In the jalopy, he had a suitcase with a lot of his valuables. He was dorming at YU and he was going home. And New York, you park the car. Car was robbed. When the father of the caller found out about it, a few weeks later, he said, I want to know how much was robbed, what the total cost is, and I'll write him a check. That's the family this girl came from. Father Tzadik Yisod, these were people I'm proud to say I knew them. They looked up to me as their rabbi. Proud to say it. So this fella marries the wealthy girl. So the rest of us got smicha. We had to go into the big world. I went into the rabbinate. It's when you were a chaplain right away. Afterwards, you were in the rabbinate. We had to make a living. We were all married. He didn't have to make a living. got smicha from YU maybe 2 years after me, and went to England to study in Jews College. Professor Kahana, they had some top people there. Professor Zimmels, I could quote their writings, their scholarship. And then he came to Israel, and he studied at Hebrew University with Professor Shraga Abramson, if you recognize the name. This was Rav Lifshitz's old chavruta, Rav David Lifshitz's old buddy, a goan adir, but totally chachmat Yisrael. His daughter later marries a fellow from the Kollel. I mean, it's many years ago. They may be grandparents already. His daughter, yeah, because his daughter was a classmate of my daughter's in Chorev. His daughter later marries a fellow from this Kollel. But Professor Abramson, so I once asked him, I said, whatever his first name is, Johnny, I said, tell me, you studied with the Rav and you studied with Professor Shraga Abramson. Give me an idea. What's the difference? He said, we study Sanhedrin with the Rav. We knew the sugyas. We knew what's going on in Rashi and Tosfos, the Rambam, the Ravid. I studied the same Gemara with Professor Shraga Abramson, and we spent a whole year attempting to reconstruct the proper text of the Gemara. So he says, I don't know any of the sugyas, but at least I can show you a proper text. And then, so Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, I see, did you study in the seminary?
Yeah.
So you know what I'm talking about.
You're studying with Dr. Weiss.
Well, you're studying with Elifni Weiss, of course, send regards, yeah. Absolutely. By the way, Professor, you should know, Professor Lieberman, they always grumbled behind his back in the Chachmat Yisrael world that he was too yeshivitic. You follow? Yeah, I understand. That's why they always grumbled that he didn't give up his yeshiva ways entirely in learning. It wasn't pure Chachmat Yisrael. But I got to tell you, Professor Shaul Lieberman was Shichmo Lamala. You should know that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein in the 60s took his class to meet Professor Liebman. They were by marriage. Rabbi Aaron was the Rav's son-in-law, and Professor Liebman was married to the Rav's cousin. So there was a connection beyond the scholarly connection. There was a blood connection. So Rabbi Aaron told the class, I'm taking you to meet a person. You can ask him any question you want in any part of Shas Prepare, and it will be as if he just learned the sugya they're asking. And they went, and they shot questions at Reb Shaul, and it was like he had just finished that Daf Gemara. They were blown away who this man was. What a man. All right, that's Reb Shaul Lieberman. Rav Kuttner was very fortunate. He could do whatever he wants. He leaves Warsaw, and he winds up in Slabodka in 1921. The Slabodka years are very important, as we will see. There he comes in contact with the author of Slabodka, Reb Natan Zvi Finkel. Reb Natan Zvi Finkel has great influence on him. I would say that to the end of his life, he considered the Slabodka years the most formidable, lasting influence on him. And the altar, you can talk about for hours upon hours upon hours. Reb Natan Kamenetsky has a world of material on the altar of Slabodka because his father was a Talmud of the altar, Reb Yaakov. Aaron Rakefit feels as if he knew the Alt of Slabodka. Can anyone tell me why? Yitzchak, who was our mashgiach in the yeshiva? Rabbi Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson. The Alt was a living personality for us. Whenever we sat, we were part of a chug. What was it called? The Musa Club.
Yeah, S-O-Y Musa Club.
S-O-Y, Student of Yeshiva Musa Club.
Afternoons.
Thursday afternoons, 1 hour. We sat with the mashgiach. It was like having the altar of Slabodka. I mean, if you saw the mashgiach Rav Lesson, you didn't have to learn any Jewish philosophy. It was a Edelkeit. All right, he was very naive. He once, he once made a comment that, what, the boys in the yeshiva go to movies, you know. He thought he was back in Slabodka. This was Yeshiva University. So some people were turned off that he didn't, but if you saw beneath the surface, oh, what an individual. Was an Iska Abita Mensch, that's a Musa.
You know, it was something to see that the Rav,
right, had touched their cherets. His svarim, the Rav appreciate his Musa Dacher. These are Musa words. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that Rav Shaul Liebman also learned in Slabodka, that it's not alien to him. And Professor Wolfson of Harvard also learned in Slabodka. So these Slabodka years were very, very important. And we'll come back to it. There's a certain episode that I'll quote to you from Making of a Gadol, which captures the Alter and his Talmidim and their impact on Rav Chutna. Then in 1925, he goes to Hebron. And you got to understand what was happening. And here I give a little background. By the way, if Yitzchak is going to ask me, why don't you lecture on it? If I start lecturing and all the names I'll mention, it'll take me 20 years to get to Rav Chutna. But Lakafir Aram, I have a monograph on the Alter of Slabodka. I have a monograph. You'll understand all about Hebron, Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein. This all fits in with Hebron, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. It's in Lakafir Aram, I believe, Chelek Aleph. Which is still available. We don't have it here, but if anyone wants it, I'll tell them how to get it. Chelek Aleph, Chelek Bet, Chelek Gimel. And you remember the picture I showed you at the start of class. My grandson's interpretation of his grandfather. My eight books are here. You can see three Rakafat Aharons and the New York Yankees. How he got that New York Yankees, I got to ask him. That's Mama Shechap, because this is a kid from Jerusalem to Haifa, lives in Tel Aviv today, but Haifa in research, what can I tell you? Now, what was happening? Whether we like to admit it or not, the winds of change affect even the most conservative institutions. Zionism was upon the world. Jews were starting to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Yes, the second Aliyah that built the State of Israel, and this is a time where the second Aliyah is taking place, the second Aliyah was 90% or more irreligious. There's no two ways about it. These are the facts. I'll deal with it in Sunday's class next Sunday in a totally different context, but this was the reality. Nevertheless, if you're a Jew, you all davened this morning, and all of us, we daven for Yerushalayim. It's part of us. You can't escape it. And people were very inspired going back to Eretz Yisrael. This affected the yeshiva world. And the out of Slabodka, already in Voloshin, go back to Voloshin, where many of these people grew up, not the out of, but in Voloshin, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, already Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook, already in Voloshin, there was a Zionist organization. The Netziv himself, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was identified as one of the great Rabbanim who supported the nascent religious Zionist movement. The Zionist club was not to be official. It was behind the scenes, and in Voloshin you're supposed to learn, not get involved with anything else. But the winds of the return to Eretz Yisrael were there. So that in Slabodka, people were thinking, we got to open a branch in Israel. The Maccabi Patish, while they were thinking, was that the Lithuanian government wanted to limit the exemption of yeshiva boys going into the army to people who had a high school degree. It's the ongoing story of yeshiva people coming out, learning the language of the land, learning mathematics, being able to be modern spiritual leaders. This was the big machlokes battleground in Volozhin with the Tsarist government. And now in independent Lithuania during the interbellum period, the same question comes up. Well, if you're going to only accept those who have a high school degree, many of the yeshiva boys did not have a high school degree. Many of them did not have a gymnasium certificate. They're going to be drafted into the army. So that was the catalyst, the Makkah B'Patish, the Zionist return, and let's get out of Lithuania. And 1924-1925, Slabodka opens a branch in Eretz Yisrael. Now, everyone knows why they chose Hebron. By the way, a doctorate was just published. A doctorate was done at Hebrew U by Tukachinsky on Slabodka, on this period that we're talking about, on the Alta and on coming to Eretz Yisrael. I went through the manuscript before it was published. Very, very fascinating piece of work. It's by it's someone from the Tukachinsky family who was broadened and has a PhD at Hebrew U. They just published another volume on Reb Shimon Shkup. It's also a Hebron yeshiva boy who broadened, got a doctorate, and wrote on Reb Shimon Shkup and his approach to Mishpat Ivri. It's supposed to be a very brilliant work. It was just published now. The Slabodka doctorate was published about a year and a half ago. So they go to Eretz Yisrael, and where do we go? Where do we turn? Where do we open? They sent some scouts to figure out where would be the best place. Yerushalayim was ruled out. Why was Yerushalayim ruled out? Because the Yishuv HaYashan was too Haredi in outlook, in appearance. They're going to bring in Litvishi yeshiva boys, clean shaven, modern clothes. They're going to declare them apikorsim, put a cherem against them. Hebron was fabulous because in Hebron you had a Chabad community. And the Chabadnikim me'oz u'mitamid were always more open-minded, more ready to accept, to receive, and they chose Hebron. It's Reb Chatzkel Sana was the one who was sent by the Alt of Slabodka, and he advised, choose Hebron. The Levush Mordechai came in Aliyah a year later, a year or so later. The Alt of Slabodka came in Aliyah, and Hebron was on the map. It became a tremendous pull. From all over the world, people fed into Hebron, including from the United States, from YU, what is today YU, from Teirut Hadas, from Chicago, from what we call Skokie today, from all over the world, to learn in Eretz Yisrael, Avira, the Ara, Hebron, the Alta. I gave lectures on this, it's not for now. The Alta of Slabodka became a different person. Never recommended anyone. Eretz Yisrael, a different approach. Lifted pieces of paper off the road, and people said, the Rebbe, what are you doing? Ein lefi kvodcha. He quoted the Gemara at the end of Ketuvot, that you don't want anyone to say the highways in Israel are not clean. Lifted paper off the road. Amazing stories. Rav Chutna was attracted. And he came for 4 years. He got out right before the massacre. By the way, to avoid any question you might want to ask, how come after the massacre in Hebron in 29, then Hebron goes to Yerushalayim and opens? Because by then the Yerushalmis recognized that although these fellas were clean-shaven in modern clothes, they were 100% filled with Yirat Shemayim and Torah. The word went out. They got to see them. They got to know them. They came to Yerushalayim for Shabbos on occasion. They saw Mativo Shel Uber Zeh. The joke is that today, almost 100 years later, 90 years later, you go into the Litvish Yeshivat in Israel, And they all look already like the Yishev HaYashan. Plenty of beards before marriage, langa begodim, long clothes. It's come full cycle. But Rav Chutno loved Eretz Yisrael. B'chol Eber Rav Shagidav. Mamish. It was a love affair, as I'll later show you from some of his writings. Loved Eretz Yisrael. But couldn't remain here long. Now he had Slabodka, Eretz Yisrael, went back to Warsaw briefly, family visit, and in 1929 went to the University of Berlin. And here you have to understand, and this is so hard to comprehend, and in the documentary on the Rav that I was privileged to bring into the world, this point is brought out. I think I say it or someone else says it in the documentary. It's hard to believe. I mean, the Rav used to say, who could believe? I spent 7 good years in Berlin. It was the center of the universe. Berlin, the liberalism, the intellectualism. Who could believe what would be just a few years later? The attraction was overwhelming. And Rav Chutno, he wanted to experience it. It's like my friend got smicha from YU, goes to Jews College, goes to Hebrew U, studies with all the famous names in the world of Torah. U of Berlin, goes to Berlin. In Berlin, he meets the Rav, and I don't have to tell you who else was in Berlin at the time, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Nechama Leibovitch, Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, Reb Chaim Hella, goes to Berlin. Now, this relationship, his year in Berlin, he was a genius, didn't have to study with professors, attended some classes, autodidactic, mastered some very basic general knowledge. Rav Chutno was quite broad, beyond Shas and Polskim and all that comes afterwards. The U of the University of Berlin leaves an impact on him that continues long after he leaves.
Did he have a degree from it?
No, he's only a year, a little over a year. From there, he returns to Hebron and Yerushalayim for again, almost two complete years. Couldn't get Eretz Yisrael out of his blood, and he's never able to get it out of his blood. And then jumps back to Lithuania, and 31-32, he's in Kovno. He's in Kovno. We're going to analyze this. You're going to see the way this is all analyzed. It's going back and forth, back and forth. But it tells you he's seeking, he's searching. He hasn't found his totality yet. He isn't complacent. He isn't satisfied yet. Kovno, few words about Kovno. Kovno, where part of my family comes from and my yichus comes from, Rabbi Revel, Kalvariski's. Kovno was in Ir Ve'Ein B'Yisrael. It was the most preeminent rabbinic position in all of Eastern Europe in the Litvische Welt. Vilna had no chief rabbi. Anyone who studied Jewish history knows the reason they had no chief rabbi is that at the time of the Vilna Gaon there was a tremendous machlokes when Rabbi Shmuel died, who would succeed him? And the machlokes was so bad that they vowed in Vilna will never have a chief rabbi again. It's like the United States of America. After this election, we should never have a president again. Let it be run by a board of trustees and end all this enmity and hatred that went into the election. Okay. Vilna never had a chief rabbi again. It had a Beit Din. And the Av Beit Din was Reb Chaim Moisek Grzynski in modern times. In my humble opinion, the Rav had the dream of being on this Beit Din and succeeding his uncle, Rav Menachem Karakovsky, who died young, 29, By 30, the Rebbe was going with a girl from Vilna. 31, the position was open. The Rebbe wanted it desperately. I spoke about this in a different context, where the Rebbe talks about the efficacy of prayer, that sometimes when God doesn't answer your prayers, that's the greatest answer you'll ever get. And the Rebbe gave an example from his life. Remember, Rebbe Heschel Schechter writes about it. I've spoken about it. He doesn't mention where, but I think my theory is 90% on, 99% correct. Ich habe gebeten, ich habe geweint, ich habe an sehr viel gewollte Stelle, die Ewigkeit mir geämpft, und ich habe ja gekriegt an der Stelle, bin ich nicht daheim, mein Freund ist nicht da, mein Kind ist nicht da, das, was ich habe nicht gekriegt in meinen Tfilis, ist gewesen der beste Antwort zu meinen Tfilis. Der Rav in Moria, speaking Divrei Agadim at the end of this year. So, Chavna was the most preeminent rabbinic. That's where Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan was Rav. That's where Rav Avram Dovber Kahana Shapira was Rav. The Deva Abraham, he was a Gon Adir of a Lushan, a graduate. By the way, he broadened over the years, Rav Avram Dovber Kahana Shapiro. And Slabodka was there. Slabodka was a suburb of Kovno, across the river, exactly. I think it's the Neman River. Across the river, little bridge. And Kovno had the Musa base medrash there, where Rav Yitzchak Blaza used to give Musa Shmuas and Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. He later went on Aliyah. He died in Israel, I believe, 1906, 1907. Mashu, because in 1907, I also did a monograph, also on Rakhafar Aram Chaylik Aleph, Rabbi Yitzchak Blaza. So that there was, Kovno had a certain spirit to it that Rav Hutner wanted to experience. So he spends a year in Kovno. Then he returns to Warsaw. Shidduch is made for him, an American lady from a very wealthy family. He marries in Warsaw his parents, and then back to Palestine, 1933. 2 years, 33, 35. Years where he's in Yerushalayim and becomes very close to Rav Avram Yitzchak, a Kohen Cook. It's the final years of Rav Cook's life. As you know, he dies in 35, but Rav Hutner yet saw Rav Cook when he was functioning, when he was healthy, when he was well. This is unlike the Rav, who only visits Eretz Yisrael in 1935, when he stands for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv, and when he visits already, Rav Cook is on his deathbed. He meets Rav Cook, and there's a lot people speak about Rav Cook. The Rav picked up stories about Rav Cook, but it's not that he gave shiurim that Rav Cook attended. He did give shiurim where Rav Cook's Talmud Mufak, Rav Chalap, was in attendance and introduced the Rav. But Rav Hutner yet saw the Rav well, alive, powerful, the final 2 years before the end. Now, his wife is American, family, what will be? He would love to remain in Palestine. But at that time, very depressed, little opportunity. America beckons, and you'll see that all the little material we have, biographical material on Hutner, you'll either see the year he reaches America is 1934 or 1935. My own feeling is that the reason there is this conflict is because of the Hebrew date. You all know that whenever you deal with a Hebrew date, let's say Tarzah, it can be 34 or 35. You have to be able to figure out when it was, the exact date. My guess is he sailed in 34 and arrived in America in 35. What we have, where did I put it? What we have of Rav Huttner in the United States, or in biography, is in the memorial volume about him, Pachad Yitzchak, Sefer Zikaron. The first part of that volume, his daughter and son-in-law do a biographical sketch, but it's not a biography in the sense that we know a biography. It's more of a, I would call it a philosophic biography. It's what he was learning, what he taught, new ideas, the facts and the intricacies of what was going on in his life are not really detailed. But I would be sumach that the year he reached America is 1935, because that's the year that they write in that biography, and I would consider that the most authoritative. It's written by his daughter, written by his son-in-law. Comes in 1935 and basically remains in America for the rest of his life, except the last decade. As you know, that final decade, he goes back and forth to Eretz Yisrael quite a few times. That's when the Pachad Yitzchak Kollel here is being organized. That's after, in 1970, you all know, we'll come back to it, he was hijacked. There was that terrible day in Israel, I'll never forget it, where three different planes, they attempted hijacked, and what was it, two of the planes were hijacked and wound up in Jordan, as I recall, and Rav Huttner was one of them with his wife, I believe his daughter, his son-in-law were with him, the entire family, and it was a terrible episode, and with miracles they got out alive. That was due to King Hussein, who fought the terrorists. Bad, bitter battles were fought right in the sand of Jordan. My own cousin later married one of the survivors, if you know Shira Finkelstein, who's Shira Daniel of Efrat. She was hijacked, I believe, could be her parents with her as well. There were others, other people we knew. It was a terrible, terrible day. I'll never forget the tension. And one of the planes that there was a shootout on the plane, my neighbor's children were on that plane, but they reached England. That was, and I believe the terrorist was released, and the British government didn't put them on trial. It's a terrible story, but that had a tremendous, tremendous impact on Rav Huttner, and from that moment on, he was not at peace sleeping in Brooklyn, and there was the constant going back and forth to the state of Israel. It was also a sad chapter in his life because there were legal difficulties. Who owns Chaim Berlin? It was not the happiest decade of his life, that final decade. We'll talk about it in more detail, but this very briefly is a historic or biographical outline of his life. I'll do more details. I'll dot the I's and cross the T's next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, and then I want to go into sources that discuss the various periods in his life. Yes, Marty.
Where was he nifter and where was he buried?
He's buried here in Eretz Yisrael in Har Menuchot.
In
Chelkat HaRabbanim, if I'm not mistaken.
Was he nifter here?
Yeah.
He was nifter here.
Is I recall. I can check it out, but I just want to see one second. He was nifter here. One second. Let me just be, this is as I recall. He died in 1910, buried in the Mount of Olives, but it doesn't say where he died. But as I recall, he died here. I may be wrong. Let's see. if they tell you anything here, period, David, no, this is, Yitzchak Kutner, no. I'll Pachat Yitzchak, but this is not, no. All right, I'll try checking it out. But unless I say to the contrary, he was nifty here. Here's the Pachat Yitzchak about his life, but I only xerox the early part. I'll check it out very simply when I leave myself a note. But that's what I recall, that he was nifty here. I was living here. I mean, it's not, it shouldn't be ancient history to me. A full nifta. You know you've lived in Israel too long when you write your notes in Hebrew, but that's life. The Jerusalem Post used to have a whole column. It is in the 70s. You know you've lived in Israel too long if, and you know, whatever, if you think the Israeli hot dogs taste like good American hot dogs. But my then there was once a column, you know you've lived in Israel too long if the bus driver knows your name. And my father, we had such a laugh, because my father, Takad, was on the same bus every day, and the bus driver knew his name. So I said, Dad, you see, you're living here too long, the bus driver knows your name. Okay, so to reiterate, we gave a brief biographical sketch of Rav Kutner. There's a world more to do. We have to, you know, color the picture. But at least now you have a framework of his life. We'll talk about that. Very, very minimal, and we'll talk about that. There's a lot that there's a lo pashut, his relationship later with the Rav, with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, with the Satmarov. It's not a simple matter, and the man was, you'll understand where he talks. I'll quote where he talks about himself. He recognized that he's not a simple individual. He was very idiosyncratic and out of the ordinary. He didn't walk in a straight path.
Was he ever invited to come to YU?
No. But you'll hear, you'll see what I have to call for Abraham Soloveitchik, the works. Oh, this Rav Kutner. Next Sunday, we continue where we left off, and we're dealing with the Jewish agency and getting people out of Russia. And what happened before World War II. And next Sunday, it's an esoteric part of the trip. Unless you know what I'm talking about, unless you know the background, no one 100 years from now will understand what the Menashe Klein is referring to. He maledicts the Jewish agency. But I can tell you, I know exactly what he's referring to, because Mori Urebi, Rebbe Shmuel Eliezer Volk, cursed the Jewish agency in front of the whole class for the very reason that Menashe Klein is maledicting them. So I'll explain that all on Sunday. And next Monday we pick up here exactly where we left off. Now, first of all, I just want to tell the class this volume came out and I read it from cover to cover. I couldn't put it down. It's just so moving. It's a malach in our midst. That's Reb Moshe Tversky, the Rav's grandson. And I remember when he was born in the 50s, and the Rav was giving a public talk, and the Rav had just come back from visiting his daughter and grandson in the hospital. And the Rav said, oh, what it means, he's his first grandson. I mean, it's a big thing when you become a grandfather. I remember when I became a grandfather, it's a big thing, a big achievement, a big feeling, a grandson. And the Rav quotes, and he says, mein Tatat gesagt, and he quotes his daughter that she says to her father, "Das is mine, das is in ganzen mine, it's my creation." And the Rav says, "Sie macht a große Tars. She's making a big mistake. It's not entirely hers, it's partially hers. It's also the Ribbono Shel Olam's." Do go and dream that that little kid, many years, not so many years later, would be killed by Arab terrorists in the heart of Yerushalayim. What makes the book very fascinating, not only the pictures of the grandson with the Rav, with this grandfather, with the Tolna grandfather, but his tzidkut, you're going to see here, he sleep over in the old city, Purim night to be sure he has a chiyuv to read Megillah on Shushan Purim. He didn't impose it on his family. Very fascinating. If anyone wants...
Is it possible to ask you, what can be done to bring students of the Kohel to this class? I want to tell you, when I was in Smicha class, Herschel Schechter's father,
Melech Schechter,
he taught, I think only one semester, a course on Shiloh and Shulis. It was the most valuable course I had, and it is a shame, like the knowledge that you shared with us today. No one from the Kohel heard it.
No one heard it. No one knows it. But I'll tell you what the problem is. I checked it out. It's not that they're against Rakefet, Chas v'Chalila. They all call me Rebbe and they say, no, they're overwhelmed by the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch. They kids here in the Kollel who are Balei Tshuva. Some of them never studied a Daf Gemara. They're in the Smicha program. Other kids are frum kids with a good background. They grew up in Schottenstein. They're overwhelmed. They have no time. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. They need new. What can you do? Say that I cannot force a student to study
so
with
me. In the old days, people would get smicha and have Feinstein's phone number.
Right.
At least they know Torah.org.
Right. Now it's why you Torah.org. You type into the Google. You ask Google the question.
Artificial insemination. Second day Yontif. Aguna. Imam Zeirut.
Right.
I mean, the Ethiopian Jews, the Indian Jews. All these were material that you taught.
All right. No, it's all here in the book. It's all here. That is all here in the book. I mean, I've taught the world more.
Funny, there wasn't...
But
is he going to work on another book?
Yeah, we're working right now.
Oh, good.
We're working right now. If anyone wants a copy of the Sefer,
yeah, I just bought one from
the okay, whatever you wish to contribute, the money all goes to Shvatami, it's all dedicated to charity. I don't touch money on principle. Natan will take the money and pass it on to Yomo, who now works for Shvatami, and you'll get a receipt from Shvatami. It's all tax deductible. If you give dollars, American tax. You give Russian. If you give ruble, it's Russian tax. We have tax exemptions all over the world, and I have in my office the latest report on what Shvatami is doing in Russia. It's very inspiring. Next to Chabad, we're the biggest player in Russia, and I always say that in public. People say, why do you publicize Chabad? Because I have to be honest. I said I want people to think we're the only ones in Russia. Chabad does great things. Now, this, Charlie, is for you. Again, you gave me that work by the Frimmer brothers. Here's another article. This is by a Rosh Yeshiva in YU who's considered more liberal than the other Rosh Yeshiva, and you'll see what he does with Aliyot for Women. Now I want to show you something amazing. I tell you, I just don't have enough words what Chabad can do. We all spoke about Ralph Branca. I don't know, was it this class or the Sunday class? Not Rabbi, Ralph Branca. I just saw him last night. A Talmud sent me a link, 1952, seventh game of the World Series. So I watch a half inning, and I don't have that much time, you understand? I don't waste my time, but when I'm all exhausted, so I get into bed and I watch, and there's Ralph Branca going down to the bullpen to warm up. He didn't get into the game, but I saw him tall the way this... Anyway, so Ralph Branca, what a tragedy. Come his mother from a frum Hungarian home, Mary comes to America, asks her parents, would you mind if I marry a Roman Catholic Italian? And she marries him and she has 17 children. It's unbelievable, the life story in the New York Times and a Prager and covered it all. Ralph Branca is Jewish. And who could believe it? I mean, my generation, when he came home after giving up the home run, his fiancée, his wife-to-be, meets him with her, with the priest, her priest, to comfort him. And he says to the priest, why did God do this to me? And the priest says, God doesn't give you a burden that you can't carry. You understand that? Unbelievable. So many, many decades go by, and anyone from my generation, we relive Bobby Thompson's home run. It was Erev Rosh Hashanah, what went on. What's the difference? I don't want to give a whole pill pull now. It's Chinuch. But Rabbi, do you know that the Rebbe sent out shluchim, what we're talking about in the Monday class, and they're told to go to Westchester, and in Westchester, they will. There's a big. I know the buildings, the offices. A lot of Jews there stand outside the lunchroom, put up a stand, and get people to put on tefillin. So these two shluchim go, and they become friendly with the people there. Among the people there, who's a businessman there? Ralph Branca. And they don't even know who he is. There's Chabotnikim. So they go over to him and say, are you Jewish? He says, no. And they get to talk with him, and he's friendly. And he's happy. He meets two teenage kids with beards, with black clothes, who don't know who Ralph Branca is. So they start to talk with him. And then he reveals, yeah, my sisters tell me my mother was Jewish. So they tell him, if your mother was Jewish, you're Jewish. Do you know that they put tefillin on Ralph Branca? He, and here, you don't want to believe it? Here, to my rabbi friend Mendy, shalom, l'chaim and blessings, Ralph Branca. Here it is. If there's anyone in this class who's a real baseball fan, I made a copy. If anyone wants it, you will honor me by taking a copy. What a story. The untold bar mitzvah story of a Brooklyn Dodger. So if anyone is interested, I can't believe it. This no one wanted yesterday. Maybe there's a more intellectual crowd here. Haifa University. Research, the Jewish vote, political power and identity in U.S. presidential elections by Gil Troy. It's during this election, but not before. The results are not yet known, but it's a whole analysis of how the Jews vote. Here is the article on Putin revealing his love for Jews, and it actually tells you, gives the name, who his next-door neighbor was. Shema Shabbos, the Anatoly Raklin, Putin's high school wrestling coach. A man he considered to be a father figure and in whose funeral he cried. What a story. Here's Chavruta by Skype on a Russian who had gone to Harvard, David, Professor David Kazhdin. Very interesting story. Here, what I spoke about, the Alter Rebbe, that the Alter Rebbe was always interested in outreach. So Chabotnikin writes to me about the Rav and the Rebbe, that the Rav in Maimonides was exactly like the Rebbe in Boston, the outreach to the people. Here is, this is my talk on Gever Tosha Menachem Machem. A student wrote it up. It's going to be published in a newspaper in Melbourne. You can see what he did. Here's the Jewish Week op-ed piece on Ari Berman. Very interesting. Here's a Meredith story with the Rebbe that I told in class 2 or 3 years ago about at the Rebbe's wedding, where he talks about the fifth night of Hanukkah. Anyone who's going to celebrate Hanukkah, it's good to bat Torah. Here are two interviews with two English people who become Chabotnikim. Very interesting. Here's the Chabad Secret by David Swisser describing the Shluchim Conference. Here's an article on the longest serving rabbi in Scotland, Rabbi Chaim Jacobs, who's in Scotland, 70 years old, is there practically 50 years. Here's the Rebbe's advice to people. Here's the story that's gone all over the websites about South Dakota. They're the 50th state to get Chabad Shluchim. I saw them interviewed by a Goya. She couldn't say the word Chabad. She couldn't say Shluchim. But the interview was beautiful. And they're young. I love their spirit. You know, we won't have a minion, but we're going to travel all over. We'll be with these Jews, those Jews. And here's the Shluchim Conference with all the pictures. The only problem with these, They don't give you names of who you're looking at. And people who have beards, I can swear I know this one, I know that one, but the beards look very, very similar. My dear students, until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya, and a special nod to the students across the world, I'm very appreciative of your friendship. Lehitra'at. Okay.